wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, I am joined by AUT Professor Alan Blackman. This week,
hi,
Alan. Barbie. Hello. We talk about making aircraft fuel from sunlight and air, fungus that uses chemicals to trick male flies into mating and infect with infected dead females, and cracking the code of unbreakable phone screens. Do you want to take us away, Alan?
I can surely do that. It's honestly, you know, if every fortnight I'm on, I'm saying, right, we'll see you in a fortnight in the studio. But, oh, gosh, it never happens. But
I know.
Yes. Anyway, so this sounds like something out of science fiction, really, is that people can make aircraft fuel from sunlight and air. That's it. That's all.
Yeah, like you said, out of thin air.
Yeah, out of thin air. And you would think that that just is surely unbelievable and it's just fantasy. But in fact, it's not. It is very much fact now.
Which is all crazy.
All workers at the ETH in Zurich, Switzerland, and at the University of Potsdam in Germany. Now, in order to understand how they can do this, we need to realize that, I'm sure as many people know, air is made up of mostly nitrogen, oxygen, a bit of argon, and then the fourth most abundant gas in air is, in fact, carbon dioxide.
Right.
And so air is around about 0.4% carbon dioxide, and you might think that doesn't sound like a hell of a lot, but, in fact, it's an enormous, enormous amount of CO2 in the air. Now, fuels are carbon-containing molecules. They are molecules that contain carbon, and what we do with a fuel is we burn it in oxygen, and it forms CO2, and it forms lots of energy as well. That's why it's a fuel. So the question then is, can we take CO2 in the air and somehow reconvert it back into a fuel? And the answer is, yeah, potentially we can, but it's going to be very, very difficult. And so what these workers have done is that they have managed to develop now a three-stage process, which they've been running for 2 years now, and they have been able to take the CO2 in air and, together with the water in air, convert that using just sunlight into, in particular, methanol, which is a good fuel, or they can also make hydrocarbons as well. Now, obviously, this is going to be a completely carbon-neutral process. That's the big thing about this, because all you're doing is taking CO2 out of the air, converting it back into a fuel, and then you burn that fuel to make CO2 again, you rinse and repeat, and on you go and on you go.
So yeah, it's like
totally carbon,
reduce, reuse, recycle vibes.
Exactly. So, and it's all solar powered. That's the really seriously impressive bit, okay? Because this is the process that needs energy. You can't just take carbon dioxide and, hey presto, turn it back into a hydrocarbon fuel. It needs energy because it's energetically uphill. It's a non-spontaneous process. So these guys in Europe, what they've done, they've basically divided this problem into three steps. And the first step is getting the carbon dioxide and the water out of the air.
And so right.
And that's a relatively straightforward thing to do, in fact.
Oh, okay.
Not too difficult at all, because CO2 reacts with things called amines, and so all you do is pass air through this big thing that contains these molecules that absorb CO2, and they also absorb water, so that's the easy bit. The next two bits are the hard bits. The first one is conversion of carbon dioxide and water, so you've got them out of the air. Now you convert them to carbon monoxide and hydrogen gas, and that's a thing called syngas, which is a common fuel precursor. And then the third thing they do is they take the syngas and then they convert that to methanol in particular. Okay, so they do all this through a combination of very high-tech methods, which, as I say, are all solar-powered, and they've been doing this for 2 years. What they can do at the moment is that they can extract 8 kilograms of carbon dioxide a day and 20 to 40 kilograms of water a day. And this is just on a small scale sort of pilot plant of theirs.
Right.
And then they can make their syngas, and during one day they can make about 100 litres of this syngas, this mixture of carbon dioxide and hydrogen. And then in the final step, they create methanol from this, again, a solar-powered reaction. And in a day run, a seven-hour run, they can make 320 mils of methanol. Now, that doesn't sound like a heck of a lot, but this is all sort of proof of process. You know, they've been doing this for 2 years. They have got the chemistry and the physics, in fact, all sorted out. And now, really, all they need to do is scale up this process, and they're away.
Yeah, I guess it's still the beginning, right? So even though this may seem small, it's actually incredible, because imagine what they can do in another 2 years.
Absolutely. And so the question that you then have to ask, obviously, now, is this going to make sense financially, okay? And what they reckon is that when they scale this up, that at current prices, they reckon that they would make fuel that's worth around about a euro 20 to 2 euros a litre. And, you know, that's almost getting into being viable, okay? And again, as you say, this is just the start of all of this. So obviously those prices are going to come down as they refine their method and as they scale up these things onto an industrial scale. And, you know, really, this is absolutely astonishing. And it's something that people have realized for a long time, that the best way to take carbon out of the atmosphere is to somehow recycle carbon dioxide. And whoever, you know, is first with coming up with a viable method for doing that is going to be extraordinarily wealthy, and they're going to be doing the planet a hell of a favor, not to mention humanity. So this, you know, it sounds really, really, really promising. It's a very, very important paper. It's been given advanced publication status that recognises its importance. And, you know, I would say watch this space in the future and see what happens with this, how the scale-up goes. And, you know, hopefully in a few years' time, this will be online and they'll be generating significant amounts of aircraft fuel in a carbon-neutral manner.
Yeah,
quite extraordinary.
Definitely. Yeah. Like you say, stay in touch with the subject, stay on this page.
Absolutely.
But, you know, speaking of flying, your second topic is about male flies and how there was fungus that can trick them into mating with infected dead females. I'm not sure if I want to know more, but I guess, well, you know.
Yes, who would have thought we'd be discussing insect necrophilia on Dear Science?
But, yeah, I guess today.
I mean, so, you know, being a chemist, I work with inanimate objects and, you know, I don't sort of get into the living side of things, but it never fails to amaze me just how perverse and amazing nature can be. And so to illustrate this, this is a story about some workers in Denmark and Sweden who've been working with a fungus called Entomophthora muscae.
Oh, I'm not even going to try say that.
I think I'm probably not even pronouncing that correctly. But so this is a fungus, and this is nasty, this fungus, okay?
It's
a
nasty living fungus.
And this is really, really nasty, because what it does is that it infects some particular insects. It takes over their nervous system, for goodness sake, and it gives them this thing that they call summit disease. And what that does is it causes the insect to climb to the highest possible point that they can. What they then do is that they spread their wings and they die. Now, they are infected with the spores of this fungus, and what then happens after they die is that if their bodies get nudged, touched at all or whatever, then these spores of fungus explode and they are thrown over the greatest possible area, because they're at the highest possible height. And that ensures the sort of the procreation, I guess, of the fungus, the survival of the fungus. And so what these researchers have found is that this fungus is extraordinarily clever. Now, what it does is that it infects female houseflies, okay? And so the female house flies get the summit disease, mm-hmm. and then they start climbing up to as high as they can, and they then die, and they've got these spores all ready to be emitted over the biggest possible area. Now, the way that the fungus does this, and God knows how it does this, is that it causes the dead female flies to emit sex pheromones, basically. They're going to attract the male flies, and it's going to attract the male flies to mate with the dead females. And, of course, as soon as they touch the dead females, bam-o, all of these spores get released.
Oh, right.
And the fungus reproduces.
Oh, no.
It's just gross.
It's a trap.
It really is. So they were doing all of these experiments with live females, with dead females, that were uninfected, dead females that were infected, and they found that the male flies showed a particular preference for the dead infected females. And so somehow these dead infected females were emitting these sex pheromones, these particular molecules that would attract the male flies into having sex with the dead female flies, and thereby releasing the spores of this fungus. You couldn't make this stuff up.
Wait, so you say that the female flies, they give off this kind of, you know, sexy vibe.
Yep.
But does this not happen with, so can male flies not get this fungus, or do they?
No, they like, do. No, they also get it as well. So they also get infected. Yeah.
Would
yeah.
they
so
then do the same vice versa for the females, or no?
No, I don't think so. It seems to be only with the female flies. But again, any touch or anything like that will cause these things to emit the spores. So somehow the fungus is just ensuring that it's certainly going to happen with the female flies. So, you know, if you've got the ingredients, it's a great horror movie there, honestly.
That is, yeah. It's quite disturbing. And, yes, again, speaking of these dead female flies, I guess a phone screen, to some extent, dies once it is smashed. But maybe trying to do real well with these segues out. could you tell me more about this? Maybe phone screens could become a thing of the past.
Well, here is a fact that I found in my readings, which is quite amazing, that Australians, every day, they lose or destroy 1,300 smartphones every day.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a lot.
A lot.
And so, you know, smartphones are not cheap. And what they have figured is that they sort of surveyed over the last 5 years, and they reckon that basically Australians are spending $150 million per year fixing these phones. And generally the problem is that you've dropped them and the screen smashes. And, you know, that's it. You need a new screen. They're not cheap, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So ideally what we want are new screens for smartphones that are unbreakable. And so people have put their mind to this, and workers at the University of Queensland in Brisbane and at Cambridge University and University of Paris, they have now developed what they think, or what they call, is an unbreakable screen for smartphones, which not only is unbreakable, but it still delivers the beautiful crystal clear images that we all are used to now with smartphones.
Oh, fantastic.
Which is, it's kind of cool. Now, the problem with the current smartphones is that the glass that they use is, of necessity, very, very, very dense, very, very, very inflexible, and therefore those two things combine to make smartphones easy to crack, or the screens very, very easy to crack. So you certainly don't want to drop them, you know, from a decent height onto concrete, because that'll be it. So these guys have been working on looking at making additives that they can add to glass to make it tough, but not brittle, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so they found these molecules called perovskites. And they make very, 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 very tiny crystals of these perovskites, these what we call nanocrystals, which are on the order of sort of 10 to the minus 9 meters, you know, unimaginably small.
Yeah.
And what they find is that they can insert these into pores in the glass, okay? They can encapsulate these nanocrystals in the glass. And, in fact, what that does is that it decreases the stress within the glass, okay? And if you decrease the stress, then it's going to be less brittle and it's less likely to crack. And they reckon that they've, no pun intended, cracked the problem here, and have been able to make a really, 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 really tough glass that is hopefully going to put all of these problems about, you know, dropping your smartphone to bed and this never being a problem again, and thereby saving, you know, $150 million a year, which is quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
And
Sorry.
as a plus to this, these perovskites can also potentially be used to convert solar energy into electrical energy and thereby help you charge your cell phone. So it could be, they're not absolutely certain, but it could be that these perovskites are going to allow you now to just leave your you know, smartphone sitting out in the sun and it'll charge up, as well as having the smartphone.
Oh my gosh, that would be incredible.
The price of one.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, you know, first word problems, I suppose, but that would be incredible.
Exactly.
thank you so much, Alan, for speaking with me this morning.
Always a pleasure.
I learned a lot, and yeah, fingers crossed that this happens with the aircraft and that we get better screens. But, you know, maybe I'll put to bed the fungus and the male flies.
Yeah, I hope you don't have bad dreams tonight.
Yeah. Cool. All right. See you, Alan.
Okay. Take care. See you. Bye.
That was AUT Professor Alan Blackman speaking with me on this week's Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.